Three rings for the elven kings under the sky. Seven for the dwarf lords and their halls of stone. Nine for mortal men doomed to die. One for the Dark Lord under his dark throne in the land of Mordor where the shadows lie. One ring to rule them all. One ring to find them. One ring to bring them all, and in the darkness, bind them in the land of Mordor where the shadows lie.
I'm Steve.
I'm Frank.
And this is
Rant of the Rings Part 3, Return of the Rant. This is it. The final frontier. To boldly go where far more talented critics have gone before me. And we finally wrap up this nightmare of my life, pointing out and just hating on all the changes that were made when adapting Lord of the Rings the book into Lord of the Rings the film trilogy.
Yep.
And
we're going to have about 25 different endings.
In each one, we, you know, horribly slaughter one of the producers of the movies in the name of justice for duty and humanity. For crimes against cinema, we hereby judge you to guilty and sentence you to catapult. So, got my notes open here.
Got my coffee right here.
We've both got coffee in true tradition, and we are going to jump right into it. Cue the background music, please. Okay, first of my notes. Pointless but not bad prologue with Gollum and Deagle. It is pointless. It's completely stupid. It doesn't need to be there. It's wasted movie time, because this is stuff that Gandalf explained to Frodo back in Bag End, when they were sitting down and talking about the history of the ring and how Sauron came to lose it, how it came down through the ages to Frodo, because Frodo deserved to know.
The whole thing with Diggle and Smeagol could have been explained in the first movie, like you said.
Yeah, like so many other things. The conversation with Frodo and Gandalf is actually pretty lengthy. It's almost as long as the Council of Elrond. I should actually count the pages sometime, but it's a long section. It's the whole chapter. Shadows of the Past. They talk about Gil-galad, and they talk about the Last Alliance, and they talk about the forging of the Great Rings.
And Frank has been so nice enough as to lend me Shadow of the Ring, or what is it called? The Return of the Shadow.
Yeah, which is... I actually want that back again now.
I have that. I'm looking at it right now. It's
Yeah, good. Christopher Tolkien, apart from compiling all his father's short stories and notes into other publications like Book of Lost Tales and Unfinished Tales, he also put together all the earlier drafts of Lord of the Rings, revealing Tolkien's writing style and his thinking process as he was developing the stories. And it's an absolutely phenomenal book. I want to get the rest of them, because you see how somebody once described Tolkien's writing style as the tide coming in. He'd make a start, come up a little way. He'd decide he didn't like something, so he'd go back to the beginning and start all over again, incorporating bits and pieces from the earlier draft, and just each time taking it a bit further and seeing how it would evolve, keeping what worked and getting rid of what didn't, and starting over from the beginning and going a little bit further and a little bit further. And you know, you see how the characters change completely from the very beginning. Like, originally, Strider was supposed to be a hobbit named Trotter who wore wooden shoes, because it was implied that at one time he had been captured and taken to Mordor and his feet were tortured. Yeah, so somehow Trotter evolved into Aragorn, the King of Men.
So you got like the most tortured of Mordor, and you just raised him up to be...
Whatever reason, Tolkien just didn't like that the way that story element would have played out, so he abandoned it and incorporated certain aspects of it and took it further. So cool. And once again, we're straying from the prologue. Okay, Smeagol's stupid voice. Still, this will never not bother me. That he has this cheap, super cheap, super lazy, uninspired Saturday morning cartoon voice, like a deranged Furby. He sounds like, if you've ever seen The Black Cauldron by Disney, there's this little character called Gurgi, just some little fuzzy guy. Nobody knows what the hell he is. But it's pretty much that same kind of voice. It says, Gurgi will love to eat apples because they're crunches and crunches. It's the same friggin' voice. If you listen to the BBC radio drama, which I highly recommend, it's so well done. The character who plays Gollum, he reads Gollum the way Tolkien used to read Gollum.
He talks very...
I can't even really... It's a little like Professor Insane almost. Sounds really whiny and wretched, you know, kind of furtive. Play a little clip from that, because this is what Gollum is supposed to sound like.
He's over there. Always there. Oxes will take you. Take you all the way. Easy to find oxes east of the river. Don't ask Smeagol. Poor Smeagol. He went away long ago. They took his precious and his last breath.
Get up. Now, can you find a path easier by day or by night? We're tired. But if you choose the night, we'll start now.
The big lights in the sky hurts our eyes, they do. We don't go looking for paths under the white face, do we, Precious? No, not yet. It'll go behind the hill soon. Yes. Rest a bit first. Nice.
You see, that's what Gollum should sound like. I mean, he never sounded like he... I don't know, what the f***? Even before his throat was all... up from strangling himself by Gollum-ing all the time, which is what they were implying in the movie, is that choking out Gollum out of guilt for choking Deagle, like he was tearing up his throat with doing that so much, so that's why his voice permanently changed. But he sounded like that before he started doing that. What?
Yeah, so they kind of took away that little element of actual, like, well, penance, really.
Yeah. And but it's like they couldn't even do that right.
I kind of liked that 70s, that cartoon that we were
the Bakshi film. Yeah, that's another great example of how Gollum should have sounded.
I got that for Christmas.
Yeah, I found all three of those at Walmart. The Bakshi film and the two Rankin and Bass films. And I picked those all up at once because, you know, I grew up watching them as a kid when we had them on Laserdisc, if you believe it.
Frank finds lots of good stuff on Laserdisc.
Well, no, back in the day, my mother, we had a Laserdisc player. We only had, like, not that many things for it because those Laserdisc players were huge. Have you seen those things, the cartridges for those?
I've seen the discs themselves.
Yeah, they're as big as a record, and they come sealed inside of a plastic. It's like a 12-foot squared floppy disk. That's literally all it was.
Well, Frank and I...
12-inch square, should I say.
Frank and I and another friend... we went to a thrift shop and we actually found the Star Wars laser discs.
We only found two of them, Star Wars and Empire. They didn't have Return of the Jedi. Maybe by the time Return of the Jedi came out, they stopped making laser discs, because it didn't have a very long run. But I'm going back to my original point. We had those movies on laser disc at first, and then when we got a VCR, my mother transferred them to a VCR tape, which worked great, except for the fact that laser discs have a bad habit of skipping a lot. So the old tape we had was full of skips that carried over from recording from the laser discs. So when I saw I could get them on DVD, I'm like, do it up. Like, okay, so we have been going on for way too long, and we haven't even started talking about the movie itself. We're still talking about Smeagol. Smeagol's transformation is just stupid looking. There was no need for any of it. Again, it's just more filler. These movies are long enough as it is. We don't need that sequence in there. We know that he went into the mountains, and over time he became a slimy little piece of shit. We don't need to see the shitty CG transition between his real eyes and the giant Gollum eyes as if that happened instantly. The makeup effects in general just looked really, really cheap on him.
Yeah, he ended up looking like the Crypt Keeper.
He looked like the Deadite in the pit in Army of Darkness.
Yep.
He looked like he hit like a dead body that had been soaking in water for a month and all the flesh was just sagging off of him. He looked pathetic. They never make it look as dark out as it's described in the book. The lands are supposed to be covered in darkness, but you can always see the sun in clear shadows. This really bothered me. Like, in the book, they describe this really heavy, heavy cloud cover coming out of Mordor, which is the Mount Doom, just pouring forth smoke for thousands of feet up into the air, and this unbroken roof of darkness blocking out the sun and dulling the hearts of men and robbing men of their will. Seeing this darkness just covering everything, it's like, what the fuck can we do against this? You know, that was one of Sauron's most powerful weapons against the world, is just covering the lands in darkness, not only to rob people of their will, but also to make it easier for his orcs to travel about without, you know, being bothered by sunlight. Now, but in the Peter Jackson movies, the darkest it ever seems is like a slightly overcast day.
Yeah, like day for night.
Yeah, not even day for night. Like, they weren't even trying almost. Like, I mentioned this in Two Towers, when they're crossing the Dead Marshes and you can still see the sunlight on them. Again, the Dead Marshes are supposed to be, like, covered in this huge mist and, you know, fogs just constantly rising from the cold Dead Marshes, so that hardly any light ever gets in. By the time they start approaching Minas Morgul, this cloud cover is already thick over the lands. Even at noon, it's like nighttime. So they weren't even trying.
It's as if they were walking through Mirkwood.
No, even Mirkwood was supposed to be darker than this. This just looks like it's a slightly cloudy day.
Well, I meant it was supposed to... Like, the way that you describe it reminds me of Mirkwood.
Oh, okay.
Where?
Well, in Mirkwood, it's just the trees are growing so old and so close together that no light can get through their branches.
Mm-hmm.
And this, the whole sky has just been blocked out.
Okay.
All right.
This is what Frank and I make a decent team, because he is the expert and I am just the devil's advocate slash, like, I at this point I've just watched the film, so I have no basis of comparison except for what Frank is telling me. But Frank is very knowledgeable because he's... How many times have you read these books?
I have honestly lost count. I've got to be close to 40 now. I'm actually currently reading it now. To any of you listening, if you're not into reading big books, you can play this in the car. Find a copy of the 1980 BBC production of the Lord of the Rings radio drama. It is beautiful. The music is great. The acting is great. The characters are great. The dramatization of the story is great.
I had to jump to, like, I think disc 7 disc 7 or something like that, just to understand what Frank was mentioning about in the previous podcast.
Oh, with the Ents?
Yes.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
It was awesome.
Ian Holm was cast to voice Frodo, which is cool because he plays Bilbo now. He played Bilbo in these movies. Sticking the Isengard chapter at the beginning of this movie because there is no room in the last one with all the made-up bullshit. If you're going to try to model this scene as close to the book as this, why cop out and give up halfway by changing it? Direct quotes in the book are mixed with more Peter Jackson shit. In the Isengard scene, about halfway through, after following the book almost word for word, Saruman suddenly pulls out the Palantir and shows it to Gandalf and everybody there. Meanwhile, Grima is standing behind him. Mind you, while they're having this conversation, Saruman and Grima are standing on the top of the tower, which is like 200 feet high.
Mm-hmm.
And they're having a normal conversation with people who are standing on the ground 200 feet below.
In Fellowship, though, they made it look as if Saruman can actually project his voice.
No. Even in Fellowship, they didn't do that. If you watch it again, which I don't recommend, Saruman comes out to that little balcony just above the door. That's where he's supposed to come out and speak to Gandalf and the king during this whole conversation.
Right.
So he's not going to, like, climb to the top of his f***ing tower and, you know, talk to somebody way down below on the ground. That's just idiotic. Secondly, you know, Grima stayed inside. He wouldn't show himself in front of the king again. In the movie, Saruman shows them the Palantir, straight up tells them this is how I've been communicating with Mordor. He insults Grima slightly, and Grima just stabs him in the back and kills him, and Legolas shoots Grima. And then Saruman does his fall from the top of the tower onto the spiked wheel, and he dips under the water, and Pippin finds the stone, and blah, blah, blah.
I have a feeling that wasn't supposed to happen in the book.
No. The reason they did that is because the third to last chapter in the entire book itself, the scouring of the Shire, it's when the four hobbits finally come home after their long adventures. They left everybody else behind. They stopped by in Bree and they had a chat with Butterbur for the night. And before they got back to the Shire, Gandalf turned aside because he wanted to go have a visit with Bombadil that he hasn't had a talk with in a long time. He's not going to come to the Shire anymore. And after days, Aragorn decreed that men were not allowed to enter the Shire anymore. And in fact, when he came to visit the Shire, he wouldn't cross over the Brandywine Bridge. So he would just greet his friends there at the border. A king has to stand by his own laws. When the hobbits finally come home, they find that everything has changed. The place, it's what they kind of showed in the Mirror of Galadriel when Frodo sees a glimpse of the hobbits enslaved. It hasn't gotten to that point yet, but the Shire is in bad shape because Saruman had been sending a lot of his men and half-orcs to the Shire to do his dirty work and basically just ruin as much of it as they could because Saruman's an a**hole like that. So he comes back to the Shire. They finally, eventually make it all the way to Hobbiton and Bag End after they had to fight a battle with a bunch of Saruman's men and drive them out. So they routed all the ruffians, as they call it. They called all the hobbits to gather together and fight together, and that's how they overcame the men. They marched up to Bag End, because that's where the Sackville Baggins is, who originally started all this crap on Saruman's orders. They go there, they find Lotho Sackville Baggins is dead, and as they're coming back outside after searching Bag End, they find Saruman and Grima there. And they have a conversation, and Frodo forbids anybody to hurt Saruman, because at one time he was the head of the Order. At one time he was a great wizard of a great and noble kind.
It was pity that stayed Bilbo's.
Exactly. Kind. But also, it's just, you know, the fact that, as Frodo says, he was once of a great noble kind that we should not raise our hands against. His cure is beyond us, but let us hope he can still find it. And he sends him on his way. And at the last moment, again, Frodo shows mercy to Wormtongue and says, "You haven't done anything to me that I know of, so you can stay here as long as you need to get your strength back." And Saruman's like, "Nuh-uh, he killed Lotho." And he's like, "You made me do it." And he's like, "And now I'm telling you to follow me, ass." He kicks him in the face. Well, he doesn't call him a**hole, but he kicks Grima in the face. Grima, this is when Grima finally snaps, jumps up, grabs Saruman from behind, and slits his throat. Then he runs off down the lane, and before anybody can stop them, a few of the local hobbits shoot Grima from behind with arrows and kill him that way. So that's when Saruman and Grima die. And that's also what makes it so horrifying, is the fact that the very last stroke of the war fell on the doorstep of Bag End. And then, for the next year or 2 years, Sam uses his gift from Galadriel, the earth from her orchard, and he goes all around the Shire and he plants new trees, and he puts a little tiny speck of the dust from his box into the roots of each tree he plants, and they all start growing like crazy. And the tree from the party field where Bilbo gave his farewell speech, that was cut down. But when he opens the box, there's also a small nut inside. So he plants the nut where the party tree used to be. And the next year, a Malorn tree starts growing in the middle of the Shire.
See, this is beautiful stuff. This is awesome stuff.
Yeah, this is, the hobbits were downtrodden, but then they discovered that by working together, they were strong. And they could fight for their own. And they could recover from anything.
Wow.
And as a reward, you know, the Shire was blessed for a long time after. And there were more babies with golden hair. And Sam's daughter, Eleanor, she actually became one of Queen Arwen's unofficial ladies-in-waiting, or one of her maids, until eventually she settled down to some guy named Fairbairn. And they became the keepers of the Red Book after Rosie finally passed away. This is long, long after the end. After Rosie died, Frodo gives his books to his daughter and the keys to Bag End. He goes to the harbors and he meets with Curdan.
What Frank meant to say was Frodo gave the keys to Bag End and the books to Sam after Rosie had passed.
And he sails into the west on the very last ship. Well, it might not be the last, because at least the last ship that departed from the Grey Havens, because long, long after, like another couple hundred years later, after Aragorn finally passes away, Legolas and Gimli sail into the west. And it's believed that Gimli was only allowed to sail into the west because Galadriel pleaded with the Valar to gain him entrance because of the love he bore for her.
You know, that Gimli, he's such a sweetheart.
Yeah. Anyway, I've just completely spoiled the entire ending of the story. We're only talking about the first damn scene.
Oh, well, did you mean to talk about it? It does tie in
because we're talking about the death of Saruman and Grima and how they weren't really supposed to die until the very end, long after the war was over and everybody had come home. The celebration at Helm's Deep is nonsense. These people are riding to war and time is essential. They wouldn't take a night off to have a party. Also, where are the northern Dunedain? As everybody is riding back from Isengard, a Nazgul flies overhead.
Yep.
Oh, no, wait. No, before even that, once they come down the road and cross the river again, they hear riders coming behind them. They turn around in case it's some kind of last-minute challenge from Saruman, and it turns out it's 30 of the Dunedain from the north who had ridden to Rohan looking for Aragorn, because Galadriel had sent messages north bidding any Dunedain that were available to come to Aragorn who would have need of their strength. And so one in particular, Halbarad, he got as many as he could together, which was about 30, and they rode like for Rohan. And with them also came Elrond's sons, Eladan and Elrohir, who are twins, by the way.
Cool.
And Halbarad also bore for Aragorn the black standard of a king that Arwen had made for him, and that would be, that's his banner as a king, the White Tree of Gondor, under the white crown with seven stars, that no lord had borne since the line of the kings had failed and the stewards had taken over. Mm-hmm. The flag of the stewards is a plain white flag. They have no symbol or device on their flags at all. They only have the authority of the king until the king returns. They're stand-ins. A stand-in doesn't have his own signal or symbol. So they meet up with Theoden and his riders. They agree to come with. They make camp for the night. And during the night, Pippin is still thinking about the ball he picked up at Isengard. He sneaks off to see if Gandalf might have it nearby because he wants a closer look at it. Steals it from Gandalf. Sneaks back off to the edge of the camp. This does not happen in Edoras. They're still way out in the wilderness. He looks in the ball for a while, and by sheer luck, he happens to be facing due east to Mordor, so that the ball is in accord with the Palantir that Sauron has, because that's how the Palantir work. Some of them have to be turned a specific way to be oriented to each other, or else they'll miss each other.
It's kind of weird. Way.
Yeah, in Unfinished Tale, there's a whole chapter about the Palantir and how they work, which is really interesting stuff. It's not very long, but they talk about all the seven different stones and where they were. And they wouldn't have had this party because after Pippin cries out and after Gandalf revives him, they're talking for a few minutes trying to work out what the hell just happened. And that's when a Nazgul flies overhead, and that's when Gandalf immediately takes Pippin and rides for Minas Tirith. And everybody else returns to Helm's Deep the following day before Aragorn uses the Stone of Orthanc, reveals himself to Sauron, and then proposes to ride on the paths of the dead. But I'm kind of jumping ahead here. Legolas is still acting like a superhero. He just seems to know everything and can do anything, including sensing the eye of Sauron all the way from Rohan. I mean, it's ridiculous. I know elves are supposed to be more perceptive than men, but come on!
Isn't Legolas the son of the king in the forest of Mirkwood?
So, they're Sylvan elves. These are descended from the elves that never went west with the gods, with the Valar in the First Age. These are the elves that began the westward journey and then decided, we'll stay here. They're just the wild elves, the green elves. They're still elves, they're still good people. It's just the fact that they have Legolas being like this supreme being. He can do anything. Nothing can stop him. He can take down an elephant with three arrows in the back of the head, and he can surf on a shield on a stairwell, and he never misses a shot. He's perfect in every way. Give me a friggin' break. And he's not going to sense Sauron. He didn't sense anything in the book when Pippin was looking at the Palantir. I'm surprised they kept as much of the Palantir scene as they did, but why did Gandalf stand around talking so long after? There's no sense of urgency like in the book. And yeah, they stand around talking for a long time. I mean, in the movie, all of this is still taking place in Edoras. Into the next morning, they're still there, talking. And then Gandalf and Pippin finally ride out, like, maybe a few hours later. I mean, if Pippin has shown himself to Sauron, and Sauron thinks Pippin is at Isengard, he's going to send his Nazgul. They're going to fly there. It's not going to take him that long to get there. It's not going to take him that long to find out they went back to Edoras. They're just standing there waiting to get attacked. Ugh, movies are f***ing stupid.
And time-lapse in movies are kind of vague, too, depending.
They don't show any indication of time-lapse, which means there might as well not be any time-lapse.
If it's not clearly spoken, or if there isn't any kind of subtitle, you know, any title going on, then it's just all gobbledygook.
They've completely... I mean, all these notes I have here are all in this one scene. Theoden's attitude is right out of his ass. The people of Rohan have a long-standing agreement to always ride to the aid of Gondor. Theoden wouldn't even hesitate to do this. In the movie, Theoden is... I don't even know what the hell his problem is.
I think he was better off being possessed.
Almost! At least then you could count on him being consistent in this. Sometimes he's nice to the hobbits, and sometimes he's being stubborn and hard-willed, and he's like, why should we run to help Gondor? Where the hell were they when we needed help? All this forced drama, like...
Where's his sense of actual nobility and honor and whatnot? As opposed to having he was like having a midlife crisis or something.
No, when I was watching the special features to the movie, they talk about... They actually try to explain this by saying that he was acting like somebody recovering from a long illness, so they're not really back on their feet yet. They might be kind of grumpy. And I'm like, no. 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 In the book, Gandalf comes in, you know, convinces him that he's not old and feeble. You know, he does something very subtle, but it's enough to remind, you know, get Theoden to wake up. His appearance doesn't change. He's still old, but, you know, he gets his strength back. He's not that old. He's still, like, in his early to mid-60s. I mean, he's been a warrior all his life. He's a strong king. And once he picks up a sword, his full strength comes back. He's ready to go kick some ass again. And, like, all of his magnanimity as a king and his honor and nobility, it's all back again. He's healed. He's whole. To have the Theoden in the movie be a crotchety old f*** who's ready to stand by and let Gondor burn when he knows he would have known full well that Gondor had plenty of its own problems, being constantly at war with Mordor, especially since the last year. So this is just more forced drama that PJ just trying to cram in because he doesn't think the story can stand on its own.
And with that, I was going to say, with that, we should be taking a drink break.
Yeah, we've talked a long time here already. So I got a lot of anger at this movie, and it's going to take a lot of time to get through it all.
This is Frank's therapy session.
10 years in the making. 10 years of trying to bleed this pus out of the festering wound of my wounded psyche.
We'll be taking a break. Within the next few minutes, you'll be listening to some music inspired or covered from music from The Lord of the Rings.
Here is some music we're going to play between the pre-recorded cuts. I'm not sure what it's going to be yet, but I'm sure it's going to be nice. Or not. Or you can just fast forward through it. Who cares? This movie sucks.
Don't say I didn't try. These tears we cry are falling rain. For all the lies you told us, the hurt, the blame, and we will weep to be so alone. We are lost, we can never.
Time to throw in more Arwen crap. Now she's having visions of her future son with Aragorn. Why is the kid wearing Arwen's pendant when Aragorn breaks it a few scenes from now? Elrond acts like he doesn't care for anything or anyone except Arwen and his elves. No. He cares about everybody. He's half elven. He's half human. His father was Arendelle. You know, he cares. Somehow suggesting that Arwen choosing to stay for Aragorn is making her weak and tying her life up with the fate of the ring. Bull****. We talked about this before.
Yep.
I got very angry about this before. There was no excuse for this nonsense. Complete nonsense. Gandalf's attitude towards Denethor is disrespectful and unwise. Also, there's no reason why he'd interfere while Pippin is pledging his allegiance to Denethor. Denethor is way over the top compared to the book. There's no subtlety. The whole scene where we first encounter Denethor in this movie.
I didn't like Denethor at all.
No, this is like community theater acting. This guy is hamming it up like a friggin' sandwich. Denethor is... he's like Michael Sheen in Twilight. He is just chewing on the scenery. He is completely out of control. Denethor is a raving lunatic. It's like in the book, yeah, he's a hard ass. He's not going to take any shit from anybody for any reason ever. Yeah, he doesn't like Faramir so much, which is, you know, he's just lashing out in his anger over losing Boromir so recently. Eventually, you know, he finds that love again before the end, as Gandalf said, although in his madness it almost turned bad. Gandalf comes marching in there like he's going to start throwing people around. He doesn't give a shit. He's not respectful to a lord, you know, sitting in his own hall. Even if he's not the king, he's still the steward. He's still in charge here. Gandalf will respect his authority. He's not going to talk proud and bolt in like that. When Pippin pledges his allegiance to Gondor, Gandalf does absolutely nothing to hinder this in any way. And he explained later that he chose not to interfere with this because he could see that it touched Denethor's fancy and pleased his humor. And that was the right way to go about it. That also meant that Pippin would now at least be welcome in the city when he wasn't on duty.
So they'd be like, hey, look, it's good old Pippin
Master Peregrine. Serving the steward. But again, even before Denethor finally cracks, he is a lord of power and wisdom and dignity. He has subtlety. He's constantly dropping hints about how he already knows pretty much anything Gandalf comes in to report.
That's because he's been using the scene weapons.
Yes, he's been using that, and actually in later writings, I think it's in Unfinished Tales, there's a whole chapter that was omitted from Lord of the Rings about Gandalf and Gimli and the Hobbit sitting and talking in Minas Tirith just during their free time after the war, and everybody was recovering from everything and just enjoying the days of peace. And that's when Gandalf tells them his side of the story of how he persuaded the dwarves to take Bilbo on their adventure and how things were very different from his perspective. And in, maybe there's some other different later writings. It's hard to keep a track of it all. Mm-hmm. But it's suggested that Gandalf long suspected that Denethor was still using, might be using one of the Palantir. So one of the reasons why he wanted to come there, apart from keeping Pippin safe and being in the right place for the war to happen, he wanted to observe Denethor and see if his guesses might be correct. Yeah. After discovering the link between Isengard and Mordor, nobody knew what happened to the Palantir after they stopped being openly used, but Gandalf long suspected that the one in Minas Tirith was still right where it always been, just like the one in Orthanc had always been there. And I keep straying. There's so much to talk about. Gandalf explaining exposition. Once again, one of the rare occasions when they quote directly from the book, but only when they find it convenient. This is Gandalf telling Pippin a little bit about the history of Gondor, and he's just regurgitating a chunk of narrative from the book. That's all it is. It's just somebody saying something for the layout, a little background for the audience. And I can't really call this a problem, because at least they're establishing the realm and some of its history. They're making it real for the audience, and at least they're doing it faithfully in this one instance, at least. So really, I should probably strike that from the list in hindsight, but
It was still something that you needed to bring up.
I really didn't need to bring that up. I can't complain about that. That's good storytelling.
Oh my god. Awesome.
They slipped one past me.
It's kind of like you're watching, and all of a sudden you're like, hey, how... Yeah.
No, that's actually the best way they could have done it. I really stopped to think about it. I was just so mad I was looking at anything to poke holes at.
I'm proud of you, man.
Okay, I gotta be fair about it. I have to be fair. If I can't be fair about this, then what good is my opinion? Frodo having premonitions that he's not going to make it back. More forced drama, and again, it's too light out. Nonsense of Gandalf coughing on his pipe because don't smoke, kids. In the theatrical cut, he smoked the pipe normally. But only in the extended cut was he, like, choking and coughing on his pipe until Pippin finally brings him a drink.
Yeah, I noticed that. I was just like, that something seems off about that, you know? Because you have, like, this, you know, this guy who's been smoking for a while. There's no way he should be choking.
Oh, no, of course not. No, he's fine. He's an immortal being, for crying out loud. A little thing like smoke's not going to hold him back. He's already died once, and he's okay. And now another prologue/montage of the forces of Mordor moving into readiness. Again, all these scenes of the orcs and stuff suiting up for battle is just filler. Okay, this note. I honestly cannot remember this scene. I have no memory of this place. Why is Pippin having a flashback to Frodo's face during a moment when Frodo was wearing the ring and invisible? I honestly cannot recollect a scene where Pippin is having a flashback of Frodo. I'm just drawing a complete blank on this. I have no memory of this place.
I mean, it might have happened, but it must have been, like, so brief.
Maybe.
And you said it was Pippin that had that flashback, right?
Yeah.
Well, maybe he heard what Bilbo had told him. Not Bilbo, freaking Frodo had told him, so that's why he remembers it as if he were there.
I don't know, dude. I don't know. I'm sure Elijah Wood is a fine actor, but his weakness from the ring shtick is full of ham. And again, this is him, like, swaying every time the ring feels like whispering menacingly, rolling his eyes, and his lip is twitching, and he's just completely open to anything Gollum says to him. Sam is too aggressive towards Gollum. He's there to follow his master and look after him. Gollum is way too obvious. He's up to something. And the idea that Frodo would let Gollum work on his mind and set him against Sam is ridiculous. Again, these are all the scenes of Gollum whispering to Frodo that Sam isn't trustworthy, that he might try to take the ring, that he's eating all their food and all this shit.
Gollum being Snidely Whiplash.
Yeah. And it's like, in the book, Frodo and Sam, they're in this till the end. They are the best of friends, and nothing's going to come between them. And again, even up until they get to Cirith Ungol, the Tower of Cirith Ungol, where Frodo was, you know, hit by the spider and taken prisoner by the orcs, even up until that time, Frodo is still completely in control of himself. His mind, he's not that weak. Frodo has deep down tough. I've said this before. He's completely aware of his himself. His will is still strong. He's still holding on with the quest. He still knows that Sam is his one faithful companion. And he still knows that Gollum is not to be trusted completely. He's not a fool. And he's not that susceptible.
And he's not that much of a cardboard cutout.
No! Movie Frodo is such a worthless nobody that all it takes is a little whispering from Smeagol, and Frodo is just,
huh? The Precious? Oh! Sam must be bad. Precious.
It's like, no. Come on.
Easily swayed.
Yeah. If the orcs are trying to sneak across the river, why are they all carrying torches?
The light of Princess.
No, it's true. That they're all trying to sneak across an Osgiliath, that scene where Faramir's men are watching the river at night, and they're carrying torches.
They don't need to. They can see.
Exactly. And they're not going to give away their position as they're crossing the water in secret in the dead of night. That's just idiotic.
Ah, look, fireflies. Fireflies out there in that big bluish net thing.
Yeah. In the book, the beacons of Gondor were lit while Gandalf and Pippin were still riding to Gondor. Now, for some stupid reason, Denethor has refused to light them, and Gandalf has Pippin sneak up to light them? Why would Denethor would never not light the beacons until after it was too late to send for help? He has the Palantir. He knows full well that Rohan's been having trouble with Saruman. He's been keeping an eye on their progress. You know, he knows Gandalf has been among them. He knows things have been happening up there. He's not going to assume the Riders of Rohan just wouldn't come. He would light the beacons early on to give the Riders of Rohan time to, you know, gather their forces and make ready to ride. And he sent the messenger with the red arrow, which is an ancient summons between the king and the king of Gondor and the king of Rohan.
Yep.
Or the stewards. It was the stewards who first gave the region that was originally called Calanardon to the riders who came from the north to their aid in their wars against Wayne riders from the east. And because their people were multiplying too numerously for their former homes up near Mirkwood, the steward of Gondor at the time gave them all that land to be their own as long as they would swear eternal friendship to each other, to always come to each other's need. And that's the Oath of Eorl. So, Denethor would not hesitate to light the beacons and call for aid, and Theoden would never hesitate to muster his forces and ride to Gondor. That's just the way things are. That's the foundation of their two realms. Or the foundation of their relationship. So, yeah.
Forced conflict.
Forced conflict, exactly. The entire course of events has been skewed. Aragorn is just hanging around in Rohan 4 or 5 days after Gandalf left with Pippin, and only now the beacons have been lit does he do anything. In the book, immediately after they come back to Helm's Deep from Orthanc, Gandalf and Pippin are already gone. Aragorn goes up into Helm's Deep with the stone, shows himself to Sauron, wrenches the stone to his own will, and used it to look down south and see the forces mustering against the people in the friendly regions south of Gondor, because Mordor is sending up a bunch of pirates and corsairs from the south to invade the bay areas and draw off a lot of help that Minas Tirith would have been counting on from the southlands. So Aragorn and his Dúnedain and Legolas and Gimli, they ride to the paths of the dead, they summon the dead to follow them, they ride something like 100 miles, they ride hard, in like a day and a night, because they have to get to the Stone of Erech, which is far, far away from where they come out of the mountains. In the movie, it looks like they enter the mountains, they pass through this tunnel, and they come out near the bay.
Yep.
They come out near the harbors. That's like well over 100 miles away. They did not run through a 100-mile tunnel in the middle of the mountains in a day. That's bullshit. They had their horses, and they had to ride hard. But eventually, they sent the dead over the water to drive out the pirates and free the slaves. And then Aragorn freed the dead there. He did not bring the dead to Minas Tirith.
Hey, if they're going to do a time lapse, they should at least have them, like, walking to the bay, silhouetted, with light in the background, and either having Hakuna Matata play, or I'm on my way from misery to happiness today.
They just make changes with impunity because it pleases them.
Yep.
We don't feel like telling the story like that, so we're just going to invent some new bull. Just Aragorn, Legolas, and Gimli are going to come through the mountains all by themselves on foot. They're going to enter a secret passage that takes them right where they need to be in like 5 minutes from Rohan.
Time
to
travel.
South of Minas Tirith. And I have to keep jumping ahead because so many things, they're threaded through the entire movie. These threads that keep branching out in more and more directions of wrongness. This movie stopped having anything to do with the book a long time ago.
Like, I feel bad for you. Like, right now, I mean, I like the movies as they are, like, as its own entity, yeah. With a few exceptions of confusion. Like, I feel bad for diehard, like, followers and nerds of J.R.R.
Enthusiasts.
Yeah, enthusiasts, yes.
Yes.
Like you. I feel bad for you for having to suffer through...
How do you think I feel?
Hollywood, basically.
Again, it's always too light. The attack on us Gileath is supposed to be at night, but the sun is high and bright, which orcs hate. Someone just randomly calls Gandalf the White Rider when it's actually a title given to him by Aragorn and taken up by the Riders of Rohan long before. And people in the city only hear it when Pippin, you know, cheers him on from the walls. Again, as I said before, Denethor is a raving madman in the movie, but in the book he's strong and proud and, in his own way, noble. Yeah. He's still the blood of Numenor. He's still dedicated to what's best for the land of Gondor. He hasn't forgotten his duties. Uh-huh. Again and again, trying to hammer in the point that their cause seems hopeless. And why the hell are the women and children still in the city? In the book, the last of them were all sent south to safety the day Pippin arrived. Yeah. In the book, shortly after Gandalf and Pippin get there, and Pippin swears his allegiance, they're shown to this apartment they can share for a while, and Gandalf goes off to the war meeting, and Pippin's left there alone, and then one of the guards, a man named Baragond, comes, and he meets Pippin, and he shows him around, he explains some of his duties, and they become friends. And then later on, Baragond has to go back on duty, but he sends Pippin down to the first circle of the city to find his son, Burgil. Pippin and Burgil become good friends, and they hang out together and keep each other company. And then because Pippin has been sworn into the service of the city and he mm-hmm. knows the passwords, he can take Burgil down to the gate and they can watch the last of the ride. Earlier in the day during lunch with Baragond, Pippin sees the last of the Wains and everybody being sent south. And then that evening, Pippin and Burgil see all the forces coming up from the south. But it's way, way less than what they really hoped for and what they really needed to defend the city, because there was already a threat coming down there and they couldn't leave everything undefended. So that was also part of Mordor's strategy, was to string out the defense. But yeah, there shouldn't have been any women or children in that city except for a few of the boys who refused to leave because they wanted to run errands and make themselves useful. And there were a few women staying in the houses of healing because they were skilled healers. But otherwise, everybody else had been evacuated. That was a fortress prepared for war.
And thus, the beginning of Red Cross, ladies and gentlemen.
Mm-hmm.
I think Frank and I are going to take yet another drink break, or at least for Frank's sake.
No.
No?
We've come to the point, this is the moment when the movie finally crossed the line. There was no going back ever again. This was the unforgivable sin. This is when the movie had officially crossed the point of no return. This is when all of the betrayal gathered together into a point and exploded like a big bang into a whole new universe composed entirely of dark matter and crap. Gollum throwing away their food, Sam trying to kill Gollum, Gollum turning Frodo against Sam, Frodo sending Sam away. All this is nonsense and forced conflict because Peter Jackson is an a**hole. This was a complete departure from the book, the essence of the story, the meaning of the story, everything. When I saw this, it just blew my mind. There was no coming back from this.
I have no memory of this place.
Even all these years later, I should have stopped caring right then and there because it obviously had nothing more to do with the book. It was just baffling.
It was infringing on the title of The Lord of the Rings.
Huh?
It was infringing on the title of The Lord of the Rings. It called itself The Lord of the Rings, yet it was not.
Well, The Lord of the Rings is Sauron.
Well played.
It's in the book. Hell, early on, Gandalf corrects Pippin and says, Frodo is not Lord of the Rings, that's Sauron. Clear and sunny skies, perfect weather for an orc invasion. This whole sequence where Denethor is sitting and stuffing his face like a slob and making Pippin sing.
Home is behind, the world ahead. There are many paths to tread through shadow to the edge of night. Until the stars are all light, mist and shadow, cloud and shade, all shall fade, all shall fade.
And we have the orcs and Osgiliath, you know, launching an attack. And you can clearly see the sunlight shining on them. Which goes back to my earlier, you know, rant about how it's never as dark as it's supposed to be. You know, that's just going to keep bothering me. Like, they couldn't even take the time to work with the lighting and make it seem dark out like it's supposed to be.
Well, at the time, they still had, like, CG graphics. Well, yeah, CG graphics were, you know, decent.
They color-washed the entire movie.
Yes.
They could have at least, dimmed this down a little bit, make it look appropriate.
They could have gone frame by frame for, like, the whole 1 second. So that's, the film was done in 24 frames per second, I suppose.
Yeah.
So they could have gone through
24 frames. Aspects of it. Just the fact that they could have done something
to
make it look right.
They could have gotten rid of the sun.
Yeah, orcs hate sunlight. Part of the reason why Sauron covered the land in darkness was to make it easier for his orcs to move about and do his business. So, the Aragorn subplot officially takes it up to the ass at this point. He comes to Duntara with the Rohirrim instead of ahead of them after looking at the Palantir. Elrond just shows up with the sword. Aragorn basically forced on his path instead of taking it by choice like a king. We talked about this in the preview episode when I had my whole rant about Elrond and how he never should have made it to Rohan in a day, even without the bullet train from Osaka. Again, as soon as Frodo sends Sam away, the entire story is broken. The movie is broken. Nothing else matters anymore. This is just complete fan fiction. This is like any .net website full of fan fictions. They just picked and chose the parts that flowed together best, and they made a movie out of it.
I would have to say that this was worse than My Immortal. 86.
Let's not get carried away. My Immortal is one of the looser adaptations out there. I mean, it follows nothing from the very start. At least this, it still carries a semblance of following the book for the most part, so it's still better by that measure.
And somehow Gandalf cries wisely.
The scene with Éomer and Éowyn talking about Merry fighting and how war is for men. More forest drama. I mean, I get where they're going here. They're trying to hammer home the point that Éowyn always felt limited by the fact that she was a woman and she felt herself just as capable as the men for riding and, you know, going to war, and she's the ultimate tomboy.
Yep.
But just this bald face shoving it right in your face, War is for men. Get back to the kitchen, part 3. Again, there's no subtlety. Elrond renames Narsila, not Aragorn. Aragorn is made completely worthless as a king and as a leader of men. Again, when Aragorn, way back in Fellowship, when the party left Rivendell, you know, right before then, Aragorn had the sword reforged, and he renamed it Anduril's the Flame of the West. And he had the Elvish smiths, you know, trace runes of power on it, and like the history of the sword, and all these other runes and everything. You know, he was getting ready to go kick some ass and become the king. You know, again, this goes back to the movie's ridiculous assertion that Aragorn is somehow reluctant to become the king, and it's just complete bullshit. Again, Legolas knows more about things he shouldn't, telling Gimli the whole history of the ancient men of Dun Harrow. Before this point, Legolas had maybe traveled to Rivendell once or twice, but otherwise he had spent his entire life in Mirkwood. He wouldn't know the ancient historical legends of Rohan and Gondor. And in the book, when Aragorn, Legolas, and Gimli come to the borders of Fangorn looking for Merry and Pippin, they talk about the Ents. And Aragorn says to Legolas, "Well, I was going to ask you more about that since you're an elf of the woods." And Legolas responds, "Well, you're more traveled than I am, and I was going to ask you, and if you don't know, then how do I know?" Their horses bolt, and they have to go forward on foot. Bullshit. The other end of the Dimmolt, the tunnel they take under the mountains. It's about 100 miles from the shores of the river where they need to be in 2 days. But somehow it opens up by the river as if Dunharrow was only an afternoon's walk from Minas Tirith. And yeah, this scene is like maybe 5 minutes, 10 at most, with the confrontation with the dead, with the ghosts and everything. But they go through this place on foot. They run from the collapsing cave, and they come out on the shores of the river in what looks like the same day, which is completely impossible. I don't think Middle-earth invented teleport panels. Okay, again, still really light despite the pall of shadow from Mount Doom. Gimli acting like a freaking clown in the cave. Yep, this is, again, turning Gimli into a walking joke. And he's, you know, acting all grossed out by stepping on the bones. And he's blowing at the ghosts and flapping his hands, trying to wave them away like a friggin' sitsy. Yeah, it's like he's acting like a friggin' Abbott and Costello movie. It's embarrassing to watch him act like this. Trying to create a moment's worth of tension as if the dead might not actually agree to fight. They've been waiting for this in perpetual death for hundreds of years. They want to be released. Mm-hmm. They're waiting for the time they're called forth to fight so they can get this over with.
What say you?
Yeah. Collapsing the cave to squeeze out another stupid action sequence. Yeah, that wasn't in the book. In the book, Aragorn, Legolas, Gimli, Elrond's sons, Elendan and Elrohir, and the Dunedain, you know, they have to leave their horses because the horses are so spooked, but they still have them, and they just walk through the tunnel, and it just seems to take a really long time, especially, but most of the narrative at this point takes place from Gimli's perspective, and it's just talking about how the whole time he's, you know, almost crawling, trying to keep up everybody else because he felt the terror more than anyone else. So, at that time, he was shamed as a dwarf. They're hardier folk than most, and I'm going to talk about that in the appendix episode. Okay. The history of the dwarves, and the history of the Ents, and the history of Bombadil, all questions that you had brought up before, and I've had more time to research and find more answers, or more possible answers.
Mm-hmm.
So we can, you know, talk, you know, hash out some of the finer details in that.
Excellent, I look forward to it.
Yeah.
I listen forward to it.
Faramir is dragged back to the city by his horse, so he failed as a captain to lead any of his men back like in the book. In the book, Faramir led the few survivors from the attack on Osgiliath back, and at the last minute, some of the Nazgul came down on them, and Gandalf appeared, and he shone the white light from his hand and forced the Nazgul to retreat, and as they were flying away, one of them threw a knife at Faramir, and he was stricken down, and he was carried back into the city by another character named Prince Imrahil, who was a kinsman of theirs, who rules the palace of Dol Amroth in the southern regions of Gondor. So, I mean, I can understand leaving out this kind of character, like, because again, there's other characters, like in Two Towers, there was a commander in Rohan called Erkenbrand, who was just completely left out. He's talked about a lot in the book, but in the end, he only appears once. The guy has never given any lines. So it's completely understandable leaving him out, just like it was understandable in the first book to leave out Bombadil.
But I really like the idea of Bombadil. I mean, that sounded...
Bombadil's awesome. A great idea, but the fact remains that he contributes nothing to the advancement of the plot. It's literally just some random encounter the hobbits had after they left the Shire, and then they went on their way. And nothing that happened during that event has any relevance on anything else that ever happens after.
Except he...
Apart from being briefly mentioned at the Council of Elrond, but even then the idea is shot down, because as the ring has no power over Bombadil, he would never really fully comprehend the importance of the ring, and he would prove to be an unsafe guardian, that he would eventually forget about it or even throw it away. And as these rings have a way of being found, that obviously was the worst thing they could have done. So Bombadil only really has power within his own land, within borders he set for himself, and he won't come out again.
Okay.
So, yeah, that's why Bombadil could be left out, because ultimately he's unimportant. He's an interesting character and a fun little adventure on the way, but that's all he amounts to.
Okay. I thought that he, well, originally, like in the book, he gave them the swords, from the Dunedain.
Yeah, and they found a way around that by having Aragorn pull the swords out of his ass. Like, here you go.
Yeah.
Well, again, the Bakshi film is incredibly compressed for time. So it goes pretty much right from the evening when Gandalf tells Frodo about the history and decides to send Sam with him. And then it cuts to the next scene of Frodo, Sam, Merry, and Pippin on their way to Bree, and they just somehow already have swords. So it's implied that they could have had that adventure and it just was left out of the movie. But then again, it also transplants the conversation that takes place in the house in Crick Hollow to taking place on the road when they reveal that they know about the ring and they're going to go with him. So at first there was like a quick line of narration from Frodo to Sam saying, and Merry and Pippin said they'd come with us to Bree. So that took a little creative rewriting, but at least it wasn't like rewriting the entire foundations of the story. So again, the Bakshi film is always forgivable for its flaws because the time and the trying to fit two books into one movie and just the animation limitations. They did a great job with it, and I have no complaints. Yeah, moving on. Denethor takes one look at Sauron's army and snaps like a twig, when in the book he's already foreseen the arrival of the army and is prepared to make a stand. I mean, later on it's revealed that Denethor had been using the Palantir for a long time, and Sauron had, from a distance, taken control of his Palantir and only showed him what he wanted Denethor to see. And one of the things he did allow Denethor to see was the mustering of his forces in Mordor to break Denethor's will, which, of course, it was working. So this does not come as a big surprise. Okay, also missing is all the extra forces that were supposed to come from the south. Pilot J deliberately changes things to add more drama. In the book, they sent for all the extra force that could be sent from the southern regions, but only a small portion actually came because the southern regions were suddenly under attack by the pirates and the corsairs of Umbar and Harad further south. They were all under the dominion of Mordor. So that's why Aragorn had to get the ghosts of Dunharrow down to the harbors to drive away the pirates and free all the men of Gondor who had been made slaves, and to free up the forces down there so they could come to Minas Tirith and tie into the battle. See, in the book, Aragorn dismisses the ghosts there. He doesn't bring them to the Battle of Pelennor Fields. That battle was won by the valor of the men of Gondor, under the leadership and inspiration of Aragorn, as it was meant to be. That was very similar to having the elves show up to Helm's Deep, which still pisses me off, just because it's completely ridiculous. Why the hell is Pippin standing around in the lower streets during the attack when he's supposed to be up in the Citadel waiting on Denethor? He had no business being down there. And even though Denethor just, dismissed him, Pippin still stuck around for a while to see what they were going to do with Faramir. When did Gandalf learn to fight like a ninja?
I have no memory of this place.
When the orcs finally, launch the attack and they start coming up over the wall and Gandalf is in there friggin' spinning around with his staff like a Jackie Chan movie. He's like, come on. Yeah, it's back to the video game part two. Okay, here's where even watching the movie I was starting to get pretty upset. This next one's long.
Here we go. I'm gonna lay back for a little while. This is gonna take.
Brace yourselves. From the moment Sam is dismissed, Frodo's story is just broken. Nothing else he says or does matters anymore. From fighting off Shelob by himself to throwing Gollum off the cliff after telling him he intends to sword the ring, or having his little daydream of Galadriel, it's degenerated into fanfiction. Also, by the way, for a lightless hole, it's easy to see in Shelob's lair. To sum that up, in the book, obviously Frodo and Sam enter Shelob's tunnel together, and they make it through together. And at one point, Frodo has Sam hold the light up while Frodo uses Sting to cut a web that Shelob had made over the upper entrance, preventing any escape. So as they finally emerge from the tunnel, Frodo is just elated by making it through this dark, horrible hole and getting some fresh air and seeing the pass right above them. He just gets overexcited. The pass, Sam! The pass! We're going to be through before anyone can stop us! And he starts dashing up the path. And Sam's trying to keep up, but he's exhausted. And then Gollum grabs Sam from behind while Shelob comes out of a side opening and goes after Frodo. So Sam has to fight off Gollum, and he eventually does manage to fight him off. And then at the last second, he remembers that Frodo's in trouble, and he runs back up, and he finds Frodo is down, and Shelob is already starting to wrap him up. So Sam doesn't even stop to think what he should do. He just grabs Frodo's sword in his left hand, and he has the other sword in his right hand, and he just wades into the attack, and he just goes after this gigantic spider, and he fights it off. And eventually, Shelob is defeated and escapes back into the tunnels. And then Sam actually spends quite a while by Frodo, trying to make sure he's dead, and debating with himself the whole chapter is called The Choices of Master Samwise. And he spends this whole time just sitting there, having a debate with himself. Do I leave him here by himself? What do I do? Do I go after Gollum? Well, that won't help. Do I kill myself and follow Master Frodo? No, that won't. That's to do nothing at all. Should I put myself forward? Well, no, I've been put forward. The council gave him the ring, but the council gave him companions, so the quest shouldn't fail. So in the end, he decides to take the ring and the Starglass. He convinces himself he's made up his mind, and he gets ready to go on. And then the orcs come out, finally, and they find Frodo's body, and they take him back to the tower. And then Sam gets locked outside.
That would have made so much better for the movie.
Mm-hmm.
I like that.
And it also establishes the fact that for a very brief time, Sam himself was a ring bearer, which is why, in the end, he's able to take a ship over into the west and follow Frodo. Merry's sappy speech to Eowyn about hope and courage when he's not even supposed to be aware she is Eowyn and not Durnhelm. Yeah, they gave this away immediately. In the book, actually, it was kept a mystery who this Durnhelm character was, who just seemed to be a young man, and after Merry was told by Theoden that he was not going to ride with them all the way to Minas Tirith, Durnhelm comes up and says, I see you want to go, so I'll take you with me. You can hide under my cloak until we're far afield and the darkness is thicker. And at another point later on in the story, when they're camping out for the night and they meet the wild men in the woods, another whole story element was completely left out. It's just a passing reference. Durnhelm was no comfort. He never spoke to Merry. He never spoke to anybody else. So it's not until Theoden's dying that Eowyn finally reveals her true identity. And even, Merry didn't know. The trolls rushing in after the gates of the city are broken, and not the Lord of the Nazgul to be challenged by Gandalf before Rohan arrives at dawn. Another unnecessary change. When the forces of Mordor bring up the giant battering ram Grond, and they smash through the gates, the Lord of the Nazgul is the first one to ride through. And there in the courtyard, all alone, is Gandalf sitting on Shadowfax waiting for him and challenging him and telling him to go back. And the Nazgul was about to attack when suddenly they hear the horns of the Rohirrim. Well, first they hear the crowing of a rooster because the sun is coming up. The darkness is breaking before Sauron intended. And with the rising of the sun, the Rohirrim launched their attack. So, for that time at least, the Nazgul retreated. And that's when Pippin catches up with Gandalf and tells him that Faramir is about to be burned alive, and they ride back up the city. On the way up, they pass Imrahil, and Gandalf tells him to take command.
See, it's all coming together.
Mm-hmm.
Properly.
Yeah. In the book. at least. Yes. In the movie, a bunch of trolls come hoarding in, they fight off a bunch of guys, and then only when they're near the Citadel does the Nazgul appear flying in, and then Gandalf challenges them, and for some reason they had Gandalf challenging the Nazgul while Pippin was on the horse with him. More forced drama and Frodo somehow getting stabbed in the shoulder with Shelob's sting when he has his mithril shirt. He was supposed to be stung in the back of his neck from behind. A completely unnecessary change. And again, his mithril coat would have easily protected him from getting stabbed in the shoulder with anything. So, that was dumb. Have to admit, Sam's fight with Shelob was pretty cool. Much like the Gandalf's fight with the Balrog, I have to give credit where credit's due. It was a good sequence.
Begrudgingly.
Yes.
Dude, I actually cheered him on like, go, Sam, go.
Oh, here's another case where I got ahead of myself, and here's a note all about this. Sam not choosing to take the ring and go on because it was the right thing to do, but because the orcs came right away and he acted on impulse. The choices of Master Samwise are completely deleted from the story. Another sign that PJ secretly hates Sam and wants to downplay him as much as he could get away with.
As opposed to giving him, like, an actual, like, 360-degree character view. You know, character build-up.
It's the point I've made before. Sam is always getting downplayed, and they're trying to push him aside as much as possible, as if Frodo is the real hero, and Frodo is nothing. Even in the book, ultimately, Frodo failed in the quest, because he would have kept the ring if Gollum hadn't bitten off his finger and fallen in with it. So really, in the book, Sam is the real, the true hero, because no matter what, he stuck by his duty, and he helped Frodo every step of the way, and he got him there in the end. But in the movies, they do everything in their power to make Sam as unimportant and uninvolved as they can get away with, including sending him away.
But which never would have happened, because they're best buds.
Exactly. And what I mentioned before, Pippin being on Shadowfax with Gandalf when confronting the Nazgul, and the Nazgul breaking Gandalf's staff. I don't know why the hell they did that.
I don't remember that in the movie.
Yeah, when the Nazgul flies in and challenges Gandalf, and he says, "I will break the wizard," and he does some evil magic, whatever, and he makes Gandalf's staff break, just like Gandalf broke Saruman's staff. And that's not from the book. That never happened. The Rohirrim wouldn't blow their horns to announce their arrival and then stand around shouting speeches while their enemies have time to arrange their defense. That's stupid. They make the speeches, they set themselves in readiness, and then they stand quiet and wait for the sun to come up, and then they blow the horns, and then they charge. Because that's what intelligent people do when they're launching an attack. Oh, here's some classic snark. "I love seeing the horses run full on into the orcs and run them down without ever stumbling once. Very realistic."
I thought about that too, man. It's like Gandalf, that's not how physics works.
No, apparently not. Well, it doesn't. Apparently it did then, but Gandalf riding Shadowfax into the Hallows, he would never do that. Horses aren't even allowed into the Citadel. And in the book, he left the horse there and went on foot with Pippin. Or directly attacking Denethor. Not once, but twice now. Yeah, earlier on, when Denethor sees the army approaching and he loses his shit, Gandalf walks up and clocks him with a staff. He would never do that. In the book, at this point, Faramir has been brought in, and Denethor just refuses to leave the room. He insists on sitting with his son in case Faramir speaks before he dies. So, at that point, Gandalf assumed command. And again, in this part in the Hallows, where he walks up and attacks Denethor with the horse somehow, which is even dumber. But in the book, you know, Gandalf comes in. He forces his way into the chamber. No fire had been set, by the way. He jumps up on the table and reveals the strength hidden within him by lifting up Faramir in his arms and jumping down with him and carrying him back out. And again, this is another scene where Pippin's friend Baragon the guard comes in, because Pippin met Baragon as he was going to find Gandalf, and he begged Baragon to go and try to stop them from bringing any fire to the place. Because the other servants were still following Denethor's commands, Baragon was actually forced to kill one of them, which is, you know, and spilling the blood into the Hallows is forbidden.
Yeah.
So there's consequences for that later. The whole scene was completely rewritten. It's stupid. Have to admit, the Oliphant sequence is pretty cool. Yeah. That was some decent use of CGI in there, and seeing them all come lumbering forward is pretty impressive. Aragorn leading the armies of the dead to Gondor instead of the armies of men from the south who couldn't come because the Corsairs, I mentioned this before. Eowyn getting stalked by the Mangle Orc and then saved by Aragorn and pals. No.
You're doing it wrong.
Here it is. Legolas taking down the elephant because he's a superhero. That was some serious video game crap. One word, all caps. Wilhelm! Eowyn even being conscious to hear Theoden's last words. In the book, the Northern Nazgul, on his flying fell beast, attacks Theoden, and the horse rears up and falls on top of Theoden, crushing his body. And then Eowyn runs up, still as Durnhelm, warns the Nazgul to stay back, takes off his helmet, reveals it's Eowyn, and the Nazgul, stops and thinks about it for a minute, because, as I said before, it had been prophesied long ago that the Lord of the Nazgul could not be killed by the hand of man. But now he's being faced by a woman, and he actually pauses to consider this for a second. But then he has the thing leap up into the air and come attacking downward, and she jumps aside and cuts the thing's head off. So then the Nazgul gets up and starts attacking her. And during all this, Merry, who had fallen off Eowyn's horse, sneaks up behind, stabs the Nazgul in the back of the knee with his sword, which, as I have told you also once before, is the work of Westerness, and no other weapon in the world would have been able to do as much damage, weakening the Nazgul, for Eowyn to finally kill it. However, the physical shock that comes from actually attacking a Nazgul is so powerful that, as Gandalf says, I think it was Aragorn who said it, shortly after the attack on Weathertop, is that all blades perish that pierce that dreadful king, and they had to be, stronger than steel to withstand the shock. So, almost immediately, both Pippin and Eowyn are just knocked senseless by attacking this thing. Although, Pippin holds on a little while longer because he hears Theoden's last words. And then they actually lead him into the city before he finally falls asleep on his feet and gets lost, and Pippin has to come and find him. Instead of what happened here in the movie, Pippin finding Merry on the battlefield instead of in the city. Yes, Pippin just strolled out of the city, and he happened to bump into his best friend in the whole world, buried under a dead orc.
His buddy senses were tingling.
Oh, that was so dumb. And it was also an excuse to cut out another scene with Baragon's son, Burgle. Sam fighting his way up the stairs like an Errol Flynn movie. By the time Sam finally gets into the tower, the orcs have all killed each other off. There's only one or two left in the place, and they're up at the top arguing. So Sam is just sneaking up. He hasn't had to fight. He encounters one orc on the stairs, but because he grabs the ring, and because the ring is in Mordor and is even more powerful than ever, the orc can sense that there's some kind of terrible power there. And plus, Sam is holding Sting, and even the light of Sting glowing is painful to the orc's eyes. So the orc runs back up the stairs. Sam didn't have to do any fighting in there. Apparently, PJ thinks Mordor is only about 3 miles across. Frodo and Sam can see the Dark Tower clearly from where they enter the Mordor by Cirith Ungol, and all their adventures along the way take place in a very short amount of time, although it actually took them the better part of a week to make it to the mountain. Actually, it took them almost... They were in Mordor for almost 2 weeks, because after they got into Cirith Ungol, they had to go north for a while. There was actually an inner range of mountains separating Mordor itself from the Mountains of Shadow on the outside. So they make the way up along this way because there's no other way to cross over the inner range yet. And then they cut east after they get, caught by the running orcs, which actually helps to speed them along for a way until they finally escape. But then from there, they go east until they're directly north of the mountain, and then they start going straight south towards the mountain, which by that point is still about 40 miles away. Wow. So, yeah.
So Mordor is pretty vast, huh?
Yeah, if you look at it on the map, it's about twice the size of Rohan, and look how long it took him to get across that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I do remember looking at the map. I recognized the map because a friend of mine had, in their video, they had, the map on their table. It was in the background. And I looked at it, and I commented. I was like, is that the map of Middle-earth? And they're like, They're like, you notice that from that far away? I'm like, yeah. I'm like, they're like, nerd. It was only because my best friend, Gordo, he has the same map, so I recognized it.
Yeah, I've got a map of Middle Earth poster hanging up in my room right now.
Oh, yeah.
Had it for a long time.
That's right. You too. It's everywhere, man. Middle Earth is around us. You know, Tolkien had it right, man, when he said that he wrote it as like an alternative history to England.
Yeah. Well, you know, obviously the Middle Earth is more Central Europe. Okay. Everybody's standing around the throne room discussing the plot instead of in Aragorn's tent outside the city because he doesn't want to enter the city or make any claim to the throne until the war is over. There's a lot of history behind this part of the book, but one of the reasons why the line of kings failed is because at one time, one particular heir to the throne, had married somebody outside one of the established families that they were supposed to marry into. And the claim to ascension was challenged, and there was a lot of fighting. It was called the Kin Strife. Aragorn doesn't want to cause any strife by entering the city or making any claim as king until the stewards have officially passed the authority on to him. He doesn't want to, you know, start up all that shit until the war has been decided. So that's why, except for coming in at Gandalf's request to help the sick people in the Houses of Healing, he will otherwise remain camped on the field.
And he's a man of his word.
Well, yeah, he's an honorable man. He's going to follow the law. He wants to make sure everything is done right because he's been planning for this his whole life. He doesn't want to screw up now. So, while Gandalf and Aragorn and the captains are holding council in the field, Legolas and Gimli go up into the city to visit Merry and Pippin in the Houses of Healing. And that's where Gimli and Legolas tell the hobbits all about what happened in the Dimmult and the battle at the harbor and how they, you know, took control of the ships and brought them to the city in time for the battle. So that's how they all sit around and tell tales and get the reader caught up on everything that's happened so far, which is a great scene. And it's also very similar to the hobbits telling Aragorn, Legolas, and Gimli about their adventures with the orcs when they meet up again at Isengard, right before the confrontation with Sauron. Another scene that was left out. Now Aragorn uses the Palantir instead of right after as Isengard. I mean, I really shouldn't be so surprised at this point that another thing was changed, but the whole reason why Aragorn showed himself in the Palantir then, like a while before, was because he wanted to cause Sauron some doubt and confusion and force him into making a move before he was ready. And that's why he had to get to the south in such a short amount of time, because Sauron moved faster than they anticipated. But Aragorn showing himself to Sauron in the Palantir now, right before marching north, there's no point to it. Changing the circumstances of how Frodo and Sam get away from the Orc March by starting a fight themselves, there was no need to change this either. See, in the book, Frodo and Sam decide to try to take a road to make it easier going and make some time, and when they stop to take a break, a group of marching orcs catches up with them, and because they're dressed like orcs, they're told to fall in and join the march. And they march a long way north, despite the fact that they're both extremely tired and Frodo is just completely wiped out. And then right at the end of the march, they catch up with some other groups of marching orcs, and the orcs themselves start a fight, trying to get to the end of the march first so they can, you know, stop being forced to run. And in all the confusion, that's when Frodo and Sam slip away. So there was no need to change that at all. The whole scene with the mouth of Sauron is ruined. First with the mouth himself looking like a cartoon character, then by Aragorn violating the terms of parley by killing Sauron's ambassador. Not an honorable thing to do, and Aragorn never would have done it. Yeah, in the book, the mouth gets away. Nothing happens to him. He comes out, he's incredibly insulting, he shows them the mithril coat and Sam's sword and Frodo's elven cloak that were taken from him in Mordor. Because, see, what happened is, after Sam thought Frodo was dead, he took Sting, because he would need a better blade, but he left his own sword beside Frodo, which was one of the swords of Western Ess. And Frodo had his elven cloak, and Frodo had his mithril coat. But Sam saved the Starglass. So, while he was trying to rescue Frodo, one of the orcs managed to get away with a bundle containing the mithril coat and the cloak and the sword. He brought them to Barad-dûr, the Dark Tower, so that the mouth could have these things to say, yeah, we caught your spy, we're going to torture him for years unless you do exactly what we say. And he lays out this huge list of demands. Merry would not have been fit to go to Mordor with everyone else. It was only Pippin who went to represent the Shire folk. Again, Merry had just been knocked on his ass by attacking a Nazgul. I mean, he was there to watch the army start off, but he was still very weak and in a lot of pain, so there was no question of him going along. Frodo was supposed to find the strength to fight off Gollum outside the Sanmath Noir, which is the gate to the chamber into the mountain. Instead, Sam just throws a rock at him and cuts him, then runs off, so Sam never has a moment of understanding with Smeagol, and finally feels some pity for him now that he knows more about the power of the ring, and why it's so hard to give it up. Yet another Sam moment cheapened. In the book, Sam carries Frodo up the last few slopes of the mountain until they come to a path,
yep.
And then Gollum jumps on them from behind, and he starts wrestling with Frodo, and this physical attempt to take the ring is the last thing that could have gotten any kind of resistance out of Frodo, and it actually, you know, wakes him up a little bit. So Frodo, being completely besotted by the ring by this point, you know, musters up the strength, and he throws Gollum off, and then Sam jumps in to defend Master and say, "Go on, Master, I'll take care of this." And then before he can strike, Gollum just collapses and starts crying pitifully and begging to live a little while longer. And at this moment, just for an instant, Sam has a moment of understanding. It's very similar to Bilbo's moment of understanding way back in The Hobbit, when he also decided not to kill Gollum for slightly different reasons. But because Sam has now borne the ring, if only for a little while, and experienced its terrible power and its the temptation it plays on the mind, he also finally feels a bit of pity for Gollum and spares him. And so he drives Gollum off and he goes into the mountain to find Frodo. But in the movie, obviously, this was rushed just so Sam couldn't have that moment. That's how it feels to me anyway. It feels like they deliberately changed that scene just to rob Sam of that moment.
I don't think it would have done Sam justice anyway, considering how much, as he said, they cut from him.
Yeah, by this point, the damage is done anyway, so I shouldn't even care. Again, I really shouldn't care. Frodo getting back up and fighting with Gollum over the ring, and then falling over with Gollum and having to be saved by Sam. Why change the climax of the entire story? This one moment ruins everything beyond any possibility of redemption or forgiveness. Again, how can Peter Jackson claim to be such a lover of the book and then make such a catastrophic change to the ultimate climax? This is what everything was building up to, and he changed it.
So he made it more, like, anticlimactic?
He made it more dumb. He made it more action movie In the book, you know, Smeagol wrestles with Frodo, yep. Bites off his finger, dances around a little bit, and immediately loses his footing and falls off. Frodo is saved almost immediately. As soon as that ring goes over the edge and into the fire, Frodo is himself again. The burden is gone. He's free. But in this, he has to have a last-minute action sequence where he actually gets up and fights with Gollum and falls off, and they're both hanging on to the ledge, and Sam has to convince Frodo not to give up and to keep trying. And it's like, up yours, Peter Jackson, in this movie.
Wow. You feeling okay, Frank?
We're almost done. That's all I can think about right now. We're almost done. Have to admit, the Eye of Sauron exploding in a shockwave of force is a pretty cool effect. But then it's cheapened by it magically and conveniently killing every last part of his entire army while completely sparing the good guys. I have a mental image of the end of Wayne's World. Let's look at the super happy ending now. Wow. Talk about just hand-waving. All the ground in Mordor collapses in on itself, but only up until the point where the men of the West are standing.
Yeah, that's kind of beautiful.
Just enough of all the ground collapses in on itself to completely wipe out all of Mordor's armies all at once.
Realistically, you'd still be fighting off Mordor's armies because they're physical, they're living, they're there.
Well, it's not just that. I mean, yeah, a lot of the orcs and stuff lost their will, because Sauron was driving them on with the force of his will, but there were still plenty of men from the Far East and the South that were still more than happy to keep on trying to fight and kill. So there was actually a lot of fighting going on after the end of the ring, with just subduing the last of the human forces. But, you know, watching this effect on screen, it looks cool at first until you realize that the front line of the Men of the West, they see the ground collapsing and see this line of emptiness coming towards them, and not one of them shifts a little bit or takes a step back as if the ground might stop falling before it reaches them.
Like, no, we're fine. We're not orcs.
Yeah, no, it's like in the Star Wars prequels where they're all just standing on giant blue screen sets. They can't see what's going on, so they can't react to it like people would react. If I saw the ground falling in on itself and I saw the edge of that sinkhole coming towards me, I'd be taking a few steps back. I'd be friggin' sprinting in the opposite direction.
Yeah. And even for good effect, I would have tripped and gained my bearings and ran.
Yeah. Nobody flinches. It's like, okay, you ruined that. In the book, the narrative after the rescue starts with Sam waking up, not Frodo. Even after everything he went through, Sam is still getting shit on by the movie. Yeah, they wake up in Ithilien. The scene opens with Sam waking up, and he finds Gandalf there. And then Frodo wakes up, and they talk, and then they have a light meal, and then they go to meet Aragorn and the other kings. And then a minstrel comes out, and he recounts the entire tale up until that point of all the War of the Ring and their adventures. And then they go to a feast, and then they get some sleep. And they stay a few days there in this place called Parth... No, it's not Parth Gallen. That was where Boromir died.
I have no memory of this place.
The Field of Cormallen. That's where they camped after the war was over and everybody was recovering from fighting before going back to the crowning. This sickening fairy tale reunion scene makes me want to puke. This is everybody coming in and jumping on Frodo's bed.
I would have been like, ow, 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 ow.
Yeah, again, they're supposed to be, like, camped in pavilions in the woods in Ithilien. Apparently, somehow, they brought everybody back to Minas Tirith, I guess. Everyone comes in one by one and mugs the camera for a second, and it's all in slow motion with muted dialogue, and the music is all slow and touching and uplifting. Here's where the relief is finally starting to show. I can't complain too much about the dozen endings. I'm just so glad it's finally over. One little nitpick, even though I completely understand why this particular thing was changed. They ignore the Scouring of the Shire chapters with Saruman showing up at bed again. It would have added at least 20 more minutes to the movie, and it's depressing as f***. And since Wayne and Garth wanted to see the completely perfect ending where everyone is happy and nothing bad ever happens again ending, Bilbo was supposed to be riding with Elrond, Galadriel, and a bunch of other elves, including Glorfindel, and they met Gandalf at the harbor. Yeah, and this Gandalf just rides up with a carriage and Bilbo in the back, and they just ride in that. But actually, shortly before the birthday, Frodo calls Sam aside, and he shows him how the book is finished. And he talks to Rosie, Sam's wife, and he says, I gotta borrow Sam for a couple of weeks, but I won't take him far. He'll be back safe and sound. And they ride out, and they meet up with Elrond and Galadriel and Bilbo and many other elves, and they ride with them to the harbors. And that's where they have the farewell. And at the harbors, slowing everything down and redubbing the dialogue just makes everyone look and sound stoned. This whole sequence is like time dilation. There's a point where slowing things down is no longer dramatic, it's just silly. And they slow it down just a little too much. You can hear the actors, you know, dubbing over the dialogue and trying to speak slowly just to match the slowed down footage. It doesn't work. I think I could have endless fun replaying and making comments over the clip of Frodo looking back and smiling. I owe you guys money, and now you're never going to get it.
Let the memes roll in.
Yes, no, this... I'm sitting there watching this, and for the first time, I'm actually smiling. Not only because the movie is over, but because the way he stops and looks back over his shoulder and gives him that big, goofy smile and that single nod. And I'm like, oh, this is gold. That would be a great video in and of itself. Just having that one clip playing on a loop and having us voice over, thinking up different jokes for him to be saying.
Dude, do it.
And finally, at last, this is the end. The rant of the rings is finally over. The ring has gone to the fire. Gollum has finally shut the hell up.
The Saturday morning cartoons have come to an end.
Yeah, we don't have to see Gimli acting like a clown anymore. Legolas can hang up his cape. Boromir is still dead. I will never, ever watch these movies again. I will never watch the second two parts of The Hobbit. I will never re-watch the first part of The Hobbit. It's over. I'm free. The burden is gone. At last. So there it is, folks. Like I said before, we are going to do an appendix episode.
Yep.
Just talking about loose ends and deeper history stuff that only nerds like me would find interesting. So, yeah, tune in.
I'm very happy for Frank. Like, right now, I can hear the angels, like, singing above
me. I just got this big smile of contentment. At last, it's finally behind me. The point I really want to make with all of this is that I am extremely jealous of Peter Jackson. This was luckier than he ever could have imagined, having the opportunity to make these movies and bring this story to life. And the fact that he blew it, he did it so badly, he did it so poorly, that he took it upon himself to alter the story and make changes. He had the one shot to do it right. And as you said once before, the chances of us seeing another remake are very slim for a very long time.
Yeah, because so these movies have made bank.
Yeah, so this is all we're going to have. And it's not good enough. He had his shot, and he blew it. And because of this, we're stuck with crap. Unless you have the animated movies. Unless you have the BBC radio drama from 1980, which I will never not recommend. If you're not the kind of person who likes to sit down and read a big book, get the radio drama. It's 13-hour-long episodes. You can listen to it in the car. Listen to it anytime. It tells the story beautifully.
Yep, and it's more digestible.
It's much more digestible. It's got great music. They got great voice actors. I mean, some of the parts of the story had to be reworked slightly for the adaptation, but they weren't, you know, altered completely. The characters were still acting like they were supposed to. The lines were still as they came from the book. So, yeah. Listen to that.
And the music wasn't bad either.
Yeah, the music was great. Read the book. Read all the books. Read The Silmarillion. Read The Hobbit. Read Book of Lost Tales. Read anything you can get your hands on. Because Tolkien spent literally his entire life creating this whole world and this whole mythology and this whole history. And he made this a real place that we could live in. You can take the initiative and learn the languages he created. People have been doing this for years. They've been writing poetry in Quenya.
And people have been writing good fan fiction based on.
Yeah, people have been writing great fan fiction on Lord of the Rings.
Writing songs, as you were saying, poetry, short stories, anecdotes, anything. And, you know, people are making stuff inspired by this entire world that Tolkien has created. Even my father, DJ Frederick, a.k.a. Green Man Took, has been inspired to make programs for The Voice of Middle Earth, as is
an excellent series. I recommend that to anybody.
Yeah, and it's treated as if Middle Earth had a radio station. This is what you'd be listening to.
And it's good music. And he found. I am always amazed at the variety of different artists and different styles that he managed to find for this project. And all the different music and the Christmas episodes and reading the letters from Father Christmas. That was adorable. The way he does his little, you know, polar bear voice.
I am the great polar bear.
That's my paw.
You go, Fred. So yeah, the world of Tolkien is vast and wonderful. And if we can all agree to never watch the live-action movies again, that'd be great. Because that's not Lord of the Rings. That's the dumbed-down, lowest common denominator Lord of the Rings that was just made to get the butts in the seats and appeal to the average popcorn audience. Lord of the Rings should never be a popcorn movie, in my opinion, because I care so much about the source material.
Frank, I applaud you.
I applaud me, too. Thank you for listening, everybody.
Yep.
Keep tuning in to future episodes of Zotcast, where we'll talk about more random things and more Transformers, because you're super awesome.
Yeah, and if you're listening to this outside of our like home base, the website zotpark.com, you go ahead, if there are show notes, click on the links. It is zotpark.com for other reviews and podcasts and radio quote-unquote programs.
Tons of videos on there. We got my guilty pleasure reviews. Got some of my stories on there. If you want to sit down and read a badly written story, hey, I'm your man.
Story time with Frank. And again, thank you for listening. I'm Steve.
I'm Frank. And Peter Jackson is horrible.
I have no memory of this place.